need to just put that light on again if you don't mind. The pastor's relationships, number one, with friends. 1-1, enjoy time with Christian friends. I put a quote there from David Brainerd. Sometimes people think of Brainerd as very reclusive and isolated figure, and he was to a large degree, but I think this quote here shows how much even somebody of his more introverted temperament, personality, how much he valued and relied upon Christian friends and how much he enjoyed the fellowship of it. And I just strung together a number of quotes there over a couple of pages in which he speaks of how much he valued contact with Christian friends, Christian conversation. And basically he says at the end, there are many with whom I can talk about religion, but alas, I find few with whom I can talk religion itself. But blessed be the Lord, there are some that love to feed on the kernel rather than the shell. Number 1-2, develop friendships with people from all levels of society. Charles Spurgeon says, the first lessons I ever had in theology were from an old cook in the school at Newmarket where I was an usher. Many a time we have gone over the covenant of grace together and talked of the personal election of the saints, their union to Christ, and so on. And I do believe that I learnt more from her than I should have learned from any six doctors of divinity of the sort we have nowadays. The cook at Newmarket was a godly, experienced woman, from whom I learned far more than I did from the minister of the chapel we attended. It was Cook who had taught him his theology. It's no discredit to the memory of a great man that he was willing to learn from the humblest sources. 1-3, learn from everyone in your congregation. Speaking of Andrew Bonar, his wife says his readiness to learn from others was very remarkable, and he had the faculty of drawing out what was best in everyone. A true disciple, he said, is always learning. Every believer we meet has something for us if we could only get it. We are wrong if we're not trying to draw out of others what God has given them. Never think you can be of no use to another disciple. God does not give everything to one. Aquila and Priscilla could do a good deal even for Apollos. I think it's a great attitude to have in engaging in pastoral visitation. Sometimes you can get into the mentality of, you know, how much of a favour I'm doing to these people, whereas, you know, you go as a learner. You've done enough talking on Sundays, you know. Go as a learner, go as a listener. And really, I believe what Bonner says here, totally agree with him. Everyone's got something to give to us. So learn from everyone in your congregation. 1-4, avoid favoritism. This is a tricky one. This is a quote from Taylor and Plummer. A pastor should not play favourites. Some ministers have been known to lavish more attention on close friends than on other members. Naturally, a pastor needs friends whose company provides fellowship, strength and wisdom, especially in times of stress and misunderstanding. But pastoral ministry must be available to all, rich or poor, and so on. It goes on to talk about the James's rebuke of showing favouritism on the basis of wealth or fame. I thought this was an excellent point, that second paragraph. I never wanted to know who our generous givers were, lest I unconsciously bow to their wishes. So I never knew who, I should say, gave what. A few times our treasurer said we had a special gift of 10 grand, but the giver doesn't want his identity known, and he kept the name a secret. Too many pastors have had to shade their conviction or deal leniently with some recalcitrant because he didn't want to offend a moneyed member. And then he concludes with, and this can be a minefield, if you're ever as is often done, say at the end of the year, going to give thanks to various people in the congregation, then be very careful to cover everyone. Don't just single out a few, especially the few visible. Try and maybe appoint a committee to select those who will be recognised. At least you then share the blame, as well as more likely cover all the bases. So avoid favouritism. 1.5, be prepared for misunderstanding. It's quite a funny quote about John Stott here. Among the hundreds of parishioners, family, students, occasional visitors to All Souls, there were always a number who felt they enjoyed a special relationship with the rector beyond what was actually the case. His pastoral care for individuals, coupled with astonishing memory for names and circumstances, meant that this was an easy mistake to make. Some of these, of course, were ladies in the congregation who had convinced themselves that they were called to an altogether warmer and more exclusive relationship with their highly eligible unmarried rector than he seemed willing to recognise. Some were clearly unbalanced, others deluded by wish fulfilment. One used to attend service after service, seated conspicuously in the very front of the church. Church wardens and rector shared a sense of some anxiety about her intentions, as did the curates. She started writing every day, and he filed all her letters in case legal action ever became necessary. She then moved her seat from the front row of the nave to the gallery, close above the pulpit. John feared, and we all agreed it was a very serious possibility, that one day she would jump in, and then what would he do? So, 2, relationships with office bearers. 2.1, beware the danger of admitting the unregenerate to membership. And that first quote there is about Jonathan Edwards' decision some way through his pastorate that he would no longer receive any candidate for full membership without the profession and appearance of Christian grace and piety. And he goes on to explain why. And of course, one of the dangers is as soon as you accept unregenerate membership, you get unregenerate office bearing as well. Elders, deacons, even pastors. So it's got to be cut off at the pass. The election the election of office bearers can be a disappointing and unsettling time. And I'll certainly put my amen to that. Here Andrew Bonner says, last night 4 elders were chosen. One of them is not a proper man, yet the people have resolved to have him. In his case, it was a struggle between the godly and the careless, and the latter gained it. What will the Lord now do? I've earnestly prayed about this matter. Stand still and see. And then later he says, have had trouble about the elders, but it's over. Spoke to one about his besetting sin. He was very angry. May be blessed to lead him to the fountain of pardon and the fountain of holiness. Before ordaining the elders on another occasion, he says, while telling the people what steps had been taken, one in the midst of the congregation spoke aloud and said that he was not satisfied as to one who was elected. This was altogether out of order. It was spread a very painful feeling through the church, but I declared the state of the case and proceeded. 2.3, get to know and love your office bearers. Get to know and love your office bearers. J. Adams says, probably the first most significant achievement of any minister who newly assumes the pastorate of any congregation is getting to know his elders well and learning how to function smoothly with them. No time can be invested more wisely during the first year of his pastorate than the time he spends developing and cultivating a close relationship to his elders. This he should do both individually and corporately. And you can go on to read a bit more of Adam's paragraph there. But also Lloyd-Jones there, he used to take his elders with him whenever he had a long journey by road or rail. And he viewed these very much as times of relationship building and getting to know one another. I think what helps there is obviously you're not just dealing with men when there are problems. You've got the basis of a relationship when problems do occur. 2:4, agree a philosophy of ministry. This is with your office bearers. Agree a philosophy of ministry. This is from John MacArthur's book, Pastoral Ministry. 8 advantages of having a philosophy of ministry are set out there. Obviously, that's not such an issue if you're going into well-established, conservative, reformed congregations where expectations are fairly well set. But it might be you're going into church planting situations or situations where you're afraid that the previous ministry philosophy has been mistaken. And so here are 8 advantages for setting that forth. And I think it also must include in that philosophy of ministry how you will relate to elders, what role you see for the elders in your ministry or in that ministry in the congregation. And I've highlighted in bold there 2 quotes from MacArthur's book about the ethical influence of leaders on one another, but also this definition I thought was helpful. It's in the 3rd paragraph there underneath the bullet points. Leadership is the exercise of one's spiritual gifts under the call of God to serve a certain group of people in achieving the goals God has given them toward the end of glorifying Christ. Hence, the pastor works with and through people to get things done. He works with and through people to get things done. So it's like, if you've got any qualms about what elders are expecting, obviously they should be addressed before you take a call. Or if in the course of a call you both parties recognise that there might be some divergence, but they've agreed to sort of listen to you. Again, right up front in the ministry, you want to get that established rather than try and do some repair work down the road. 2:5, in similar vein, agree criteria with which to judge growth in the congregation. Agree criteria with which to judge growth in the congregation. MacArthur says the church is a worshipping community, a witnessing community, and a working community. A worshipping, witnessing, working community. In other words, the church is to exalt the Lord, evangelize the world, and edify its members. Everything the New Testament commands the church to do falls under these headings. He goes on, Paul made clear that the purpose of every pastor is not to fill the auditorium with people, nor is it to preach wonderful sermons or entertain a congregation or collect salary. The minister's task is to help every believer become Christ-like, to prepare every child of God for meeting the Lord and Saviour on that great day. And then he goes on to talk about the plan, the pain, and the power of pastoral ministry. I'll leave you to read that. 2:6, seek constructive criticism. John Stott writes, I think it's to his elders, I rather feel now I've settled in a bit, it's too much to ask you to write a full critique each time I preach. Could we have the arrangement that you send a line only if you've a special word of criticism or commendation? Could you be especially sensitive to these 2 broad questions about each sermon? Is it worth saying? Is it well said? In other words, is there a real message here, something vital, relevant, gripping? And has it gone across? Or was it too heavy, too complicated, too boring, etc.? I'd be awfully grateful if you could do this. It's really especially adverse criticism I want to hear, such as you might hear while leaving church. 2:7, help the office bearers make decisions. I don't think this is quite as much a difficulty in Dutch Reformed churches as in Scottish Presbyterian churches. I've noticed there's a lot more parity. I mean, there's theoretical parity of eldership in classic Presbyterianism, but I think there's even more practical parity in the Dutch Reformed situation. The elders certainly seem to me to be a lot more... I'll just use the terminology, on the same level as the pastor in consistory situations. That might be just from my own limited experience, but in the Scottish system, it often comes back to the pastor makes the decision. You know, if there's a difficult decision to be made, suddenly the elders get quite quiet. And it's really trying to drag out an opinion. And they're all, you know, they're looking for you, to you. You know, you fire the bullet, and you know, we're right behind you. Way behind. So, you know, part of leadership is trying to, you know, make that decision collaboratively and corporately, so that you stand or fall together. So some of that is helping elders to make decisions. And so here in this quote, again from MacArthur, I think helpfully sets out a decision-making process. And it might seem really straightforward and common sense, but I think it's still helpful just to help you have a structure for doing this. So he has there five steps. Step one, correctly diagnose the issue or the problem. Step two, gather and analyse the facts. Step three, develop alternatives. Step four, evaluate alternatives, pro and con. Step five, select from among the positive alternatives. And I think sometimes our mistake is trying to get step five too quick. Nobody wants to say what they think step five. But you try and get people engaged in one, two, three, four. They're talking already. Opinions are forming, and it's much easier to express the decisive voice at the end. Again, some helpful distinctions there. From Adams, three major modes of church leadership: the dictatorial, the consultative, and the participative. And Adams greatly favours the third, as I do too. And then Adams also highlights a manual. I haven't seen this, but I thought I'd put it in the notes. Maybe one of you can seek it out at some point. A manual by George Scipione on how to train elders, taking elders through all the relevant passages. I think that might be well worth trying to find. 2.8, learn how to delegate. We covered a bit of this, well, quite a bit of this actually in the leadership class, so I'm not going to go over this again. There's a helpful mnemonic acrostic at the bottom of the page there, using the letters of the word delegate to help you through that process. And then at the end of that section, from Adams again, he has, when a pastor on his own tries to do the work of the entire congregation, what happens? And he has five fails. He fails because. And I think it's well worth reading that, just as a caution to you to try and avoid the one-man band approach. So learn how to delegate. 2.9, inspire the office bearers. So we've had train the office bearers, help them make decisions, learn how to delegate. Also inspiration. And this really, as this quote says, I don't seem to have a reference for it. But as it says here, this ability to inspire is an almost unconscious thing. You're not, you know, entering your congregation each week saying, right, I've got to inspire them all. But there should be an element of, when you appear, you know, there's some energy that comes with you. And I'm sure we all know pastors like that. It's not Again, it doesn't need an extrovert type of personality to communicate this. We have different ways of conveying this. But as this says, good leaders inspire discouraged and demoralized people. They add new life to a dying organization. Sanders said, the power of inspiring others to service and sacrifice will mark God's leader. His incandescence sets those around him alight. It's not enough to be at the front of the pack. The leader must also inspire the pack to pick up the pace and do it with a willing and enthusiastic attitude. And then some hints there as to how to develop an inspirational ministry. And interestingly, maintain a vibrant and fresh devotional life is at the very foundation of this. So basically saying, you know, don't go around like an Eeyore all the time, or that's the kind of people you'll develop. You don't need to be a, you know, Jack in the Box either, just, you know, super bouncy. What's the Winnie the Pooh character? Tigger. You don't need to be a Tigger, do you? But somewhere in between. 2:10, remember the tribal leader. Foremost among those from whom he should seek counsel is the tribal leader. Every church has one, and in most cases, it's committing professional suicide for a pastor to cross him seriously. I know of a church where pastor after pastor has followed each other in rapid succession. Each of these pastors was young. Each has been intent on bringing about radical change. In each case, the pastor's short tenure could be traced to his engaging in pointed, direct confrontation with the tribal leader. It seems that none of them had learned the knack of winning him over, and no doubt he became ever more difficult to win because of the increasing number of pastors with whom he had difficulty. I'm sure you're all thinking of your own congregation and the tribal leader in it. I think it's usually a woman, personally. So look out for her. Two 11, ask for a raise as a last resort. Ask for a raise as a last resort. A couple of examples there. One from Prime and one from Glynn, How to Survive the Ministry, or How to Survive in the Ministry. A couple of examples there as to how to go about this. The middle quote there from Glynn makes a helpful point. Remember, you're setting precedents. And he used to decline raises, basically, when they were offered. And, but the knock-on effect was the rest of the administrative staff in the church also didn't get a raise. So, and also remember, if you're not taking the offered raise, you're affecting the next pastor that's going to come in as well. So, don't ask for a raise, but basically saying don't turn down one either. And interestingly, Lloyd-Jones's conviction was a pastor should live among his people, be dependent upon the means which they provide, was so strong that he gave all his savings to his mother before leaving London. It meant that for some years, Bethan was to count every penny of her housekeeping money, an exercise which she did not regret. That's not necessary, is it? I mean, his basic point was probably, I don't think he had a lot of money, but he was a doctor in Harley Street and probably far more savings than anyone in the mining town he was going to in Wales, and wanted to feel what it was like to live amongst people and their means. There's some merit in that. Still wouldn't give my savings to my mother. No offence, Mum, but... 2:12, practice Presbyterianism. Practice Presbyterianism. And again, it's just an appeal to treat ruling and teaching elders with equal authority. Let's just get to the end of this elder section quickly. Beware the small things, 2:13. Small things in relationships become big things, basically, Bonar's saying in that quote. 2:14, trust the Lord for peace in church courts. Bonar says on Monday, anticipating an unpleasant meeting of Deacon's Court, while praying beforehand, the Lord showed me how one drop from the fountain of life, one beam of his love, one thought of his holy presence, one text about himself, could at once quiet and restrain every spirit among us. And I prayed this in opening the meeting. The dreaded outburst passed quietly away and everything came out in peace. I really like the practice here, whether it's committees or church courts. There's opening not just with prayer, which was our practice in Scotland, but of a reading and a brief devotion, a brief meditation on scripture. I think it really helps to just set the tone and put people in a better frame of mind, especially with controversial matters to come up. 2:15, church discipline cases can ruin you if you make one mistake. And this is really the sad case of Jonathan Edwards, what really ruined his ministry. There were really these problems with the young people in the area, and they made a list of the young people that they wanted to come to the parsonage to question, and it was startlingly large. And through mere forgetfulness or inadvertence on his part, Edwards failed to distinguish between names of suspects and those who were to be called simply to give information. So he's in the pulpit, he reads out this long list, but there's no distinction made between those who were, you know, up for accusation and those who were being called in as witnesses. And so very quickly the whole town was ablaze with controversy, and the youth of almost every prominent family in the congregation were implicated. And for the next 2 months, the case just devoured the congregation. And when the ringleaders of this offence saw how divided people were and how, you know, Edwards had mishandled it, they grew in confidence and boldness. And even when they were called to the parsonage to express penitence, we read, some engaged in playing leapfrog in the yard while waiting to be interviewed, while another climbed to an upstairs window to view a few girls who were also waiting to see the committee. And those who spoke of the committee spoke in very contemptuous terms. And thereafter, Edwards felt a severe lack of support in the congregation, his leadership was impaired. And Dwight, the biographer, says, this was the occasion of weakening Mr. Edwards' hands in the work of his ministry, especially among the young people, with whom by this means he greatly lost his influence. It seemed in a great measure to put an end to his usefulness at Northampton. He certainly had no great visible success after this. The influences of the Holy Spirit were chiefly withheld, and stupidity and worldly mindedness were greatly increased among them. Amazing, isn't it? What a great mind, yet what a great blunder. One mistake. At 2:16, expect problems with church building projects. Expect problems with church building projects. Again, Edwards here is an example of this. Where are we going here? That quote number 20. Yeah, I think this is MacArthur. He's asked, You survived a number of building programs at Grace Church. What's the secret? The secret for me, says MacArthur, was to let the lay leaders guide such projects and stay out of them myself. I do not think I can remember attending more than 5 meetings about new buildings in 25 years. We never had trouble with raising money to build because we never built a building until the need was so pressing that we were just crying uncle out of desperation. What does that mean? Uncle means give up. Yeah. Oh. We never built an edifice or monument to the church or to ourselves. And he goes on to describe the pressing need. And he said, we always built frugally, as inexpensively, and yet with as much quality as we could. We always had the full and unanimous support of our elders so that we could go back to our people and tell them we want their support in this because we all believe it's God's will. Their trust in the spiritual wisdom of their leaders and the obvious need always made them willing followers. Cultivate volunteers, 2:17. The lack of volunteers is one of the greatest tragedies in the church today. In fact, there are so few true volunteers in the modern church that we probably need to remind ourselves of what a volunteer is. A person who, by his own initiative and free will, steps forward to perform a task. Such persons are so rare in Christendom today that most Christian leaders go into temporary shock when approached by one. Our world is becoming a spectator society produced by addiction to entertainment and by the increasing role of professionals in our church. I think that's MacArthur. Sounds like him. So cultivate volunteers.